what do you see as being the main near-term impacts? Obviously, we'll get a bit of a run-up in certain, you know, related entities and maybe tokens. But in terms of the sort of the way the contours turn, what do you see? I mean, I'm particularly interested in what companies might do, you know, your Circles, your Tethers. And there's a whole host of people coming on board to the whole stablecoin piece now, right? What's your view?
My thought is what we'll probably see is all of the major banks in the US, you'll see them if they don't have a stablecoin strategy, if they haven't built, if they haven't bought, if they haven't partnered with somebody, you'll probably see announcements out of all of them that they're looking to integrate this because it's just such a no-brainer cost-saving thing that you can do, right? Yeah. And the other thing you'll probably see is for established players in the space like Tether and even Circle, they really had this offshore focus to their business. And you saw Tether actually focus a lot of their investment in things like Bitcoin mining and other ancillary lines of business. You might start to see some of that investment kind of come home back into stablecoins and back into the US.
You're listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets, the home of informed conversation about crypto for institutions building the future of finance. Brought to you by CF Benchmarks, the world's largest crypto index provider. Hey everybody, thanks for joining us for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. I'm Ken Odelega, Head of Content, and as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, Gabe Selby, who's Head of Research, and Mark Pilipchuk, who's our Research Analyst. Hi guys.
Hey Ken.
Hey Ken.
Today we have an exciting episode. If you've enjoyed the year so far, I mean, enjoyment is a bit of a sort of like a weighted word, but it's certainly been action-packed markets-wise and geopolitically for various reasons. Have some sympathy for our research team because basically they have to document this and quarterly create an outlook document, which they've masterfully done right now. The subtitle is Alpha in the Aftermath, Moving Beyond 60-40. Gabe and Mark, when I was reading the outlook, I sort of thought, obviously, the aftermath could relate to all sorts of things, geopolitically, politically. But the 60-40 aspect, you know, really does bring in your various portfolio perspectives, which seem to be on every page. And certainly you have a little bit of information, portfolio perspective, a little bit of information, portfolio perspective. How does that title bring everything that you're trying to achieve in this report together?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the main thing is that we're seeing a lot of macro forces and we're seeing a lot of regulatory forces and we're seeing a lot of idiosyncratic forces that I think are creating this trifecta of making a really constructive case from Bitcoin all the way through the altcoins. And so if we just start with like the macro side of things, well, we've seen a lot of Fed uncertainty. You know, we've got a president and an administration kind of at odds with the chair of our central bank. And then that's creating a lot of uncertainty with the fact that the central bank doesn't want to cut rates anymore. So they're on pause and they think that inflation's coming back. While at the same time, you've got an incredibly large increase to the fiscal budget that's coming through Congress. One thing that people aren't talking about is you know, the fact that we're going into the August recess in a few weeks.
Yeah, good point. We
don't know really if the government's going to quite make it through the continuing resolution that they passed back in March. Now, some tariff revenues have kind of helped the budget here recently, but our previous D date, which was what we were using an August date for when the government could run out of funding, and no one's even brought this continuing resolution up. So it goes back to this sound money principles kind of 101 with Bitcoin. And that's really been evident in the price action. We just saw Bitcoin ripped right through 120,000 on a weekend session. And it's just really being supported. When we go to the regulatory side, we're seeing a lot of tailwinds as well, because we're seeing, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, this is crypto week. We're seeing the Genius Act move through. It's probably going to get signed before the August recess. The Clarity Act is going to get voted on in the House, and then it's probably going to get tossed around a bit. We expect that to maybe come through in Q4, Q1 of 26, Q4 of 25. And all this means is that you're just going to see a lot more, I think, building, a lot more capital investing, a lot more people coming to the table, and that stigma that we were talking about earlier as well, starting to go away. on the kind of idiosyncratic thing, Mark's got a lot of great points that he brought into the Outlook with some of those key features. And I'll let him maybe talk about that just briefly.
Yeah. So when you kind of think about with that other line we have a going moving beyond the 60-40. I just want to kind of go step back and think about why we need to do that, because it sounds pretty radical.
Yeah.
But if we look
if
over
the 60-40 exists even, which a lot of people that we speak to say, it's always been a bit of a model, you know, sort of.
Yeah, it's always been more of a model. Yeah. Recently with the move into alternatives, we can argue that it's been dying for a while. But if we look at from a technology standpoint, over the last 25 years, I looked this up, the USM2 has increased about 350%. So we've had incredible currency debasement. What's interesting, though, is like over that time period, the CPI has only moved up about 100%. Now, we can argue whether or not we think CPI is the best inflation metric, but that spread is still there. Now, if we look at why that is, it's all of these productivity gains from technologies. So if you look at the NASDAQ over the same period, the 25 years, you got about a 450% price return out of that. So if we think back to what we talked about earlier, where stablecoins can unlock all these efficiencies in banks and payment processing, there's a good chance that investors will see a massively outsized reward from this technology, essentially creating efficiency in the economy. So we talk about things like tokenizing stocks. We're talking about, obviously, stablecoin payments. And then we're also talking about some of the trades that can show up around that, whether that's ETF inflows, investors kind of piling in. We'll see what we plan to see. We should see a lot more of that this year. And the basis activity with proof of stake assets now being in ETF form, and we have staking in a Sol ETF, that staking reward, when you combine that with a basis trade, adds another return component that should improve liquidity in the whole space. So all these things can work together to take this asset class from the $4 trillion it sits at today to maybe 10, 20, 50 trillion, you know, over the next decade or so. And we're going to see all that show up in the economy. We'll see that help kind of pin down inflation, even though we'll see currency debase, and the result will be an amazing return here.
It's like you're no longer able to just ignore the asset class. At this point, you're making an active decision. And I've heard this, that whole kind of like active, if you ignore it, meaning that, you know, it's such a big representation of the global market portfolio now that if you don't have any sort of allocation into digital assets, you are taking an active bet to be underweight it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the way into this now, since we've actually begun with what we're seeing in the market, obviously Bitcoin's all-time high, 120K in recent days. In a way, it's almost a culmination of a lot of the trends that you've actually mentioned, Mark and Gabe. The first section in the Outlook is the market recap. So let's go through that to sort of set the scene. Clearly, you cover the fact that digital assets have weathered the turbulent second quarter, buffeted by all the geopolitical and political influences that we know and love, the tariffs, necessarily explicitly mentioning this sort of like global geopolitical turmoil, but you know, it's there, maybe it represented economically. The off again, the on again sort of aspect of this sort of tariff policy and the easing momentum in May. But then maybe pick up the thread there, guys. What are we seeing now where we are in this sort of constructive sentiment? What is this constructive sentiment reacting to politically and economically that investors have deemed to be so positive?
I think a lot of it is just the fact that, one, you had the Liberation Day sell-off, which was pretty dramatic. That was something that was felt across most markets. But to be fair, I think digital assets performed, you know, relatively better than many of would have suspected. And when he dialed back the proposed tariffs on Liberation Day to something more moderate. And again, we're still facing some of these uncertainties as we kind of roll over into the month of August. We've just seen broader participation with some of the larger cap tokens, you know, Ether's rallying, doing a lot better as far as its price action. Solana's also held its support areas, but Bitcoin, really the major point of the major weight in our CF broad cap index, which is what we use on that chart, is just doing really, really well. So if you have to attribute it to those things you're seeing, you know, a lot of Bitcoin increasing the value of the index. And I think a lot of that is going to be kind of outlaid here in this conversation with the macro regulatory and micro headwinds or tailwinds?
Yeah. So for me, a couple of the key turning points for me during the quarter were really like on the crypto specific side. We had the Pectra upgrade for Ethereum in May, and we saw kind of a post Pectra rally in early May, call it early to mid May. And what we saw there was kind of interesting because we saw Bitcoin dominance actually top out shortly thereafter around 66%. And we did see a little bit of an altcoin catch-up trade towards the end of the quarter. And it was on the back of a couple of things. We had it was shortly after the Genius Act advanced through the Senate. We saw them catch a bid. And it was also after the Clarity Act kind of moved its way out of the House Ag Committee and the Financial Services Committee. And while the bill is probably going to change from what we saw, what came out of committee, just having a general idea of what things we're looking at is good. And we got positive commentary out of the SEC. We saw Paul Atkins come out and say that they aren't going to get in the way of innovation. They're going to take a look at these assets for what they are and create clear rules of the road. And we've seen a bit of a shift in behavior from this SEC to the last one, where we're actually getting regulatory engagement and feedback out of them. You can go to them and you can ask them, what guidelines do you have? And they'll come back to you rather than say, there are no guidelines, but you have to register. That was we're not seeing that anymore. So sure. All those things really work together to cause investors to take another look at the space.
By the way, guys, if you want to follow along with this episode, clearly cfbenchmarks.com is where you need to go. You need to go to the Research and Insights tab and click the first item on the menu. The section that we're addressing now, the market recap, is on page 4, I want to say. And there's an amazing chart, digital assets rallied in the second quarter. You can actually get a graphic representation, illustration of the market momentum and beta, digital asset-wise, throughout the quarter with some annotations on the chart that actually explain a little bit of why we saw what we saw. So then if we want to move on to the macro section, then basically, it is the macro backdrop. The first subsection within that is the growth outlook. And this brings in the Fed and the fact that the GDP was revised down during that quarter. And consumers are pulling back, as Gabe and Mark point out. The sort of first paragraph reads, the US economy enters Q3 2025 facing deeper headwinds than anticipated. Initial optimism following the election and expected rate cuts has been replaced by a weakening macro environment, although the full implementation of the Liberation Day tariff package was ultimately postponed. The implementation of the 10% universal import tax and targeted reciprocal measures has already introduced significant trade frictions. Now, I think the good way for you guys to actually bring this to life is the fact that it seems to contradict what we're actually seeing in the market, as we've described a little bit earlier. Let's deal with why we're not necessarily seeing those impacts right now.
Well, we are an index provider for digital assets, so we don't actually have, per se, hard forecasts for our GDP figures. We are using the consensus forecast, and we're just kind of showing that on our chart. One thing that I'll just summarize for our growth outlook is just the downside risks largely remain with the consumer. The thing that we highlight in the chart is just we broke everything down as its percentage contribution to total GDP overall. And the orange bar in the stacked bar chart there is your personal consumption. And you just saw how much that fell in the first quarter. That pullback is something that, you know, is quite notable, just considering the fact that you're seeing, I think, a consumer that's largely being impacted by the uncertainty in the market right now. The other things that we highlight are just the noise that you're getting from the tariffs, NetX, right? Component and also the change in inventory. So you saw a lot of firms front loading the inventories and trying to get in front of the tariffs. That also skewed imports to be dramatically higher in the first quarter, which really dragged the real GDP figure into negative territory. But, you know, just to kind of give nod to the fixed investment portion of Q1 GDP, that's a lot of the AI spend that companies are spending a lot to try and ride that wave and get in front of that. But just to summarize everything, it's really just downside risks remain to growth. And I think that's largely really centered on a weakening consumer.
Yep. And we got some data out of China this weekend that was kind of interesting too, that kind of plays into the import export. They did see a surge in exports in last quarter, which I actually didn't expect with the front loading in Q1. So that kind of tells me that we're going, that we didn't see the end of the noise with that import-export data last quarter. I think we'll see that. That will continue to move GDP all over the place for the next couple of years.
That's a good point, because that net exports surge does seem a little bit late, right? Negative surge, right? It seems a little late relative to where we were, we thought we were in relation to tariffs, right? You know, obviously we can't see into the future. I'd love to see some bars on the rest of that on the rest of that chart. But in terms of mean reversion, is that a sort of a reasonable thing to expect? Regard to exports and obviously the impact on growth.
That's kind of tough to forecast, I think, because of just the ongoing uncertainty of what the final tariff rates are going to be. Mark's brought
it's
up
impossible
a really
to
good
forecast,
point.
Actually.
That's where maybe we can just kind of take a line from the administration with what's called core GDP, which basically is a term that refers to GDP with stripping out the volatile components like the NetEx component, which net exports, and also inventories. So I really think, you know, it's going to be difficult to, I say we're going to continue to see a lot of noise in those components, but really the overlying trend is just weakening consumers.
Yeah. Good. It's a good point, which is not often top of mind, I think, from what I can see in the discussion. So basically, the Fed is in an impossible position, as we know. Tariff uncertainty, which we've mentioned, we sort of like need to take a leaf from the administration's book, and then we're still none the wiser. Tariff uncertainty and softening labor market is the sort of subheadline immediately under this, the headline in this section. What are the headline impacts of those two factors, guys?
Yeah, so the problem with the tariff uncertainty for the Fed is when they're trying to come up with their goals are obviously maximum employment and price stability, and it's relatively difficult to achieve price stability when you don't know what the import duties are going to be on things and how that's going to play through to the consumer. And it's also tough from an employment standpoint, because we would have expected by now that a softening consumer would have led to higher unemployment than it actually has. And it's kind of shown up in the participation rate. Instead, we're seeing a lower participation rate. But it's a tough balancing act for them. And what they have to consider, if you cut this too late, there is a 6 to 12 month lag effect between the effective federal funds rate and it moving through to the economy. So if they wait until the unemployment spikes and goes north of 5 or 6%, that they could be too late, and they could end up with this 6 to 12 month period where the economy is getting worse, even as they're trying to make a policy response. So that's what they have to try and avoid. And you've seen them kind of acknowledge that rates are restrictive in some of the Fed speak. So you are starting to see it trend a little more dovish. But Jerome Powell, within his seat as chair, is still holding the line.
Yeah. And I want to get us swiftly on to the next juicy point, because as you guys point out, we may be entering a shadow chair situation. Gabe, do you want to sort of outline what you mean by this shadow chair thing?
So a shadow chair is essentially going to be a figurehead that will be the successor, the eventual successor to Jerome Powell once his term's up in May 2026. I know there's a lot of chatter on social media right now of Powell possibly resigning before his term ends.
We don't believe
that's probably going to be the case. And there's all sorts of talks now of trying to find some sort of corruption charge with some sort of remodel that was going on at the Fed. But let's stick with our base case that for now, you know, Jerome Powell is going to stick with his role at the Fed through May 2026, which leaves us to, you know, what could the administration do to kind of short circuit what they consider to be a very hawkish chairman. So what they could do is, like I said, jump the gun, announce the successor early, and that successor could start to lead market expectations sooner. So that person, he or she, may begin to signal that once they take the position, he or she will try to convince the rest of the committee to lowering rates dramatically. We already know that the committee is pretty split between some hawks and doves. And we saw that in the most recent FOMC minutes. But overall, we're seeing a lot of, you know, risks and cracks. You remember our first call this year was for bond vigilantes. And we included kind of an update chart to that with the Treasury tail risks, what this chart shows is the fact that we're seeing a lot more tails in the auctions. And what that essentially means is if you look at a treasury auction, you know, they know their market participants pretty well. These aren't your Joe Schmoes that can show up and bid on treasuries. They're you know, the largest banks that are, you know, authorized to participate in these dealer auctions. And with each auction, we've seen less appetite. We've seen the tail increase. We've seen kind of a trend for larger tails, which means that they're getting less demand, and the price that the treasury is actually receiving for when they auction these bonds off is actually below, which is increasing the yield somewhat. So with that, we've kind of outlined, you know, our base case is for 3 rate cuts. It kind of ties into what we anticipate happening in the growth side with the consumer cracking. We think that the Fed and will have more room to kind of maybe implement the shadow chair's vision before he or she takes office. And along with that, we still see the potential for some non-traditional measures on the monetary policy side. So if we do see another round of tariffs come in next month, we do see more uncertainty and we start to see cracks again in the treasury market like we saw in April, there is a possibility that, you know, they could do some shadow QE, they could do some sort of other programs. But, you know, over a 12-month horizon, which would put us into June of 26, we anticipate, you know, even yield curve control could come into play if we see term premiums really pick up again.
Do you see any specific signs of this shadow chair right now? Any sort of indications that, you know, this is a real possibility?
I think it's going to happen this quarter.
Oh, wow.
I think, you know, before September, particularly, you know, let's just, a lot can change very quickly. But if we assume that, you know, the tariffs that he's proposing to enact in August actually come to fruition, which there's a big possibility that they might not, I think you might see some more pricing pressures. And we call for that in our inflation outlook. And that might increase the urgency to get a more dovish speaker, because the term premium on the bond market is probably going to start reflecting that if you do start to see some of these leading indicators of inflation start to play out. What that means from a portfolio perspective is that protecting your purchasing power is more important than ever. So when you look at assets like Bitcoin, this is really, I think it's time to shine. We've got a regime that wants to put probably an artificially lower interest rate than even what I believe, which I do think interest rates should be lower. I think that growth is really starting to materially slow down. And I think any sort of inflation is probably going to be relatively transitory. But the main thing is that the administration really wants rates to just be cut even lower than what I'm saying. So I could say zero maybe is what their appropriate rate is. Yeah. And with that, we really are going to see, I think, a lack of monetary prudence, a lack of fiscal prudence with the spending that's going on in Washington. And that's really a good setup for Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't want to sort of stay, you know, mired in this section, but, you know, there's all sorts of other potential knock-on effects from the scenario that you're outlining, Gabe. They could be beyond, they're partly political. And obviously we can see the political having an impact on sort of economic behavior and also market behavior. If the administration shows signs of undermining the authority of the Federal Reserve, that's a big issue, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Right. Then the next section, while we're still on a sort of like monetary sort of policy aside, is the inflation outlook. And you see the core, you've mentioned the core inflation earlier, and the headline diverging. Do you want to take us through that on a top line basis to begin with?
Yeah, at the top line, you're seeing a few interesting things kind of unfold. So on one hand, you're seeing, I think, a lot of deflationary forces coming from AI, which is increasing productivity. We expect that to kind of continue. So that's kind of continue to kind of help reduce services inflation, which is what we've seen in the data. At the same time, the categories that are going to be most impacted by tariffs are going to face pricing pressures. So that's where you're going to see that divergence that we're talking about. That's going to create this like tug of war relationship. So I would say, you know, keep an eye on those categories. We get the import price index every month. That's an interesting data point just because that excludes tariffs. So theoretically, if the cost of the tariff were to be borne by the exporting country, meaning the country that's exporting something to the US, they should be reducing their prices by the amount of the tariff. And what we've seen so far is that's not been the case. So in essence, basically a lot of the tariffs are being absorbed by the importers, aka the United States, and those will either be passed on to the consumers or they'll be eaten by the actual, you know, business or corporation, which would reduce margins. So we'll keep an eye on import prices. That's probably going to give us some lead on what's going to happen with those categories and inflation. But overall, from a portfolio standpoint, it's kind of like the same narrative from the monetary side, where we're seeing this to be a nice setup for assets, real assets. You know, we talk about like anything from real estate or gold, but also mostly Bitcoin, which I think has the highest sensitivity to this type of trade.
Yeah. And one other thing that just to watch on the inflation front, it's that divergence, that core versus the headline. The elevated geopolitical uncertainty we've seen, that's going to show up in the headline where you have volatile things like food and energy really moving around. I would almost discount that, and I would almost expect the Fed to discount some of that movement in coming months. So if you see a higher or hotter headline CPI print above 3% or something in a few months, I almost wouldn't worry too much about it. I don't think that's indicative of stickier inflation.
Yeah, I want to get the perspective of our resident AI expert, Mark, based on something that actually you said, Gabe. How material is that impact on productivity, which feeds through to growth? My perception, it's kind of marginal right now. Am I among the many who are actually discounting that aspect a bit too much?
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's where it's showing up. As if you think about it, the US is largely a services-based economy, and it's going to show up on the cost side of all those companies that we have. And the thing to watch for me is AI is not to the point, or these models aren't to the point where they can replace somebody who's, you know, highly skilled or an expert or a specialist in their field. What it is replacing is it's those kind of entry-level roles, and like think about junior devs or junior researchers or something like that. And if you look at the unemployment rate for the under 30 crowd, you can actually see that ticking up in the US and every other major country. That's where I think you're going to kind of see the impacts of AI. And that's where you are seeing it right now.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And then I want to get you guys to talk to this point, because I'm looking at the third bullet point or third subheading under inflation outlook. Despite recent headline volatility, our baseline forecast anticipates average CPI inflation, so headline, to settle just under 3% in 2025. That's despite everything. That would be a creditable performance by the US, actually. Could you put some color for that for us?
Yeah. So when we think about the headline inflation and kind of the components that make it up, one of the largest components is shelter. That's that owner's equivalent rents, about a third of the total in the headline index. If we look at that and the kind of look at where the housing market is, it's been pretty flat. It hasn't been as hot as it was in 22. And remember, there's a lag effect on that owner's equivalent rent.
Yeah.
So now we've had a couple of years for the housing market to settle out. And because that's such a large component, that should kind of remain anchored. And where you'll see that the transitory flare-ups is, like I mentioned early, any commodity shocks due to geopolitical uncertainty, or you could see one-time hits from tariffs. But overall, yeah, it shouldn't pick up or anything like it did in 2022.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about 3% as if it's, I mean, it is, it would be an amazing performance, but it's almost like structurally above trend, right? Above,
like a 20-year average or 2.5%. So yeah, you would be north of the 20-year average, but still nothing compared to what we've seen.
Absolutely, yeah. The crazy situation that we could be in, right?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, just to add to that, is that you're not going to see as much demand-driven inflation.
Yeah.
So that's what really really was the rate of change in COVID. We have that chart in there. Is, yes, there was some supply, but when you look at the demand-driven inflation, which is something that the San Francisco Fed breaks out on their PC index, it really just was like flat, and then we just saw a hockey stick move to the upside. So that's really, I think, not going to happen now. And a lot of it is probably because, yeah, you're getting the deflationary impacts of AI. And as Mark pointed out, it's going to displace probably lower end workers first. Well, if you have less workers, you know, earning income, that's certainly not good for demand. Not to get too dystopian on the podcast, but
no, I mean, I see it as positive, frankly.
A lot of nuance, yeah, between what's happening with inflation. But overall, we see these forces really playing out. And that's the, you know, on the core side, you'll see the services deflation. And on the headline side, you could see some goods inflation with tariffs. But how long that lasts, we don't think it's going to be terribly long. It should be pretty transitory.
You know, it's a sort of unforeseen effect, largely unforeseen, certainly by me, that we would see potential productivity gains based on such a new technology, and they coincide with the sort of political atmosphere and also the economic impacts of that in a way that is kind of net beneficial, I would say, frankly. But I do like your portfolio perspective on this slide, actually, Gabe and Mark. Real assets come up as a sort of like, and quality equities with pricing power, obviously, and of course, Bitcoin as well. You're lumping them all together. Do you want to sort of like speak to that at all?
What I would quickly just say is we do feel like it's the fact that they all have the same denominator when we're talking about it, which is the dollar. And with dollar debasement, you're going to want to have things that are harder to get and harder to reproduce. So real estate does qualify, gold does qualify, and Bitcoin is unique because we've seen it empirically have the highest, I think, slope, the highest sensitivity to that. And, you know, we talked about briefly the SAB 121 repeal. Well, if you're going to start seeing these lending teams at banks, you basically have introduced a new asset that can be collateralized. And with a fractional reserve banking system, that means that you can create more money. So introducing an asset that can be collateralized, that can be lent against, means more money supply. So regardless of what the Fed does or what, you know, we know borrowing is going to go up, but the fact is that the denominator is set to increase for a series of reasons, not just the ones that we highlighted just now.
Absolutely. And let's get on to the section that you've called regulatory outlook. And we've kind of talked about, I'm not going to say, we should still touch on these in a little bit more detail, but I want to jump to something that we actually haven't mentioned so much. The SEC to revamp digital asset ETF listing, which is something that CF Benchmarks, as the biggest provider of crypto, regulated crypto indices to the sort of product providers, the ETF industry, were particularly interested in. On July the 1st, the SEC issued comprehensive guidance for crypto ETP issuers, clarifying NAV calculations, custody practices, and a whole host of other aspects, conflict of interest disclosures. And you guys anticipate by the end of September, the SEC will roll out universal listing procedures for spot crypto ETFs in partnership with national stock exchanges. In other words, clarity, long sought after clarity. What could be the impacts of that for our particular corner of the financial industry?
Yeah, with this, it's going to open up the spigots because we've already kind of seen that with the approval. I guess we could see the foreshadowing coming from the approval of the Grayscale Large Cap Trust that was approved to become a spot ETF. However, they put a hold on this. The reason why they put a hold on this is because...
Yeah, that's a complicated one. Yeah.
they are wanting to have actual framework in place. So they're saying, yes, you can convert, but let us go ahead and gather some feedback. Let us get our ducks in a row. And then we can, you know, proceed with the conversion to a spot ETF. But what we believe is going to happen is we're going to get a lot of feedback from the national stock exchanges. So you have the New York Stock Exchange, you have the NASDAQ, you have the SIBO. These folks are going to be providing their guidance and what they think is fair for guidelines for listing tokens on a spot offering or in a regulated spot ETF wrapper. And what those rules and regulations, what that framework might look like is we're going to see, you know, X token might need to be listed on X number of constituent exchanges. It will have to have X number of volume turnover, X amount of liquidity, and it's not going to probably be so centered on having the, you know, regulated futures market tied to it, which is, you know, what we were seeing before with the CME, which is one of our close partners. So that's kind of what we're expecting to see happen. And that's probably going to happen sometime in September, which would green light, you know, these basket ETFs, essentially, is what the change is. You're going to have these basket ETFs coming to market, you know, shortly thereafter that, maybe in September or October.
Yeah. Can I get you to speculate as well, Mark?
Yeah. So I'm starting to think that the biggest thing here, the key thing to focus on, will be the basket ETFs that come out of this. I'm not so sure that if we look at the track record of some of the other single asset funds, once we start getting down the market cap list from Bitcoin and Ether, there's just less investor interest. The funds are harder to market, harder to explain. And if we're just understanding Bitcoin and not an institutional space, and we're kind of just dabbling in Ether now, we are very far from talking about Bonk Fund and token launch pads. That's probably a year or two down the line. But I think that investors are beginning to realize that with all of these regulatory changes, they affect different sectors of the market. It is no longer just Bitcoin that's impacted. And what you need is a fire and forget solution, one where you can go ahead, allocate to the whole asset class. You don't have that risk over you where if I buy Solana and that's not the main chain, you know, I'm going to underperform the market. That's what you really want.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to that point, a lot of our clients have effectively built into, you know, some of their existing portfolios, which of course are just Bitcoin and Ether right now, a mandate to track, you know, the legislative progress of additional assets through the regulatory apparatus, meaning that they will actually, you know, these other assets will come on stream, as you say, in a fire and forget manner, as the rulemaking progresses, right? And I think we're going to see a lot of that. And I think, you know, again, I think I agree with you guys that maybe what this would be the real inflection point, because what we've seen so far is kind of not necessarily natural for the investment, you know, the actual business of investing. You don't just invest in one. You know, you might have to you might get away with it for a while with crypto, given the sort of weight of the Bitcoin beta. But it is a sort of a portfolio process, right? And it's meant to be a portfolio and a diversification process for all sorts of reasons. And that could be the real unlock, right? We've got a whole bunch of clients who already provide these portfolios on a private basis and would love to do so, you know, in the ETF wrapper fully. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense to see some sort of like major impact from that once we see the regulations enabling it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about, we'll use Bitcoin as the example here. We saw it with the ETFs when it came out. If we ignore what the price did and we just kind of think about the liquidity and the types of participants that the ETF brought in, because now you have a vehicle that's BlackRock IBIT today is $80 billion. So you could allocate with size to that fund. It turns over enough volume where you can easily move in and out. And it becomes a sort of no problem thing. And the problem that a lot of the other crypto asset class has once you get below Bitcoin and Ether is that liquidity is really not there. You can't allocate to that with size. And these ETFs will help fix the liquidity problem, which will then in turn lead to larger allocations and of course provide that price tailwind and creates that feedback loop where as the asset class gets larger, you have to continue to allocate to it.
One thing that I didn't see you guys mention is the CBDC. Is it the anti-CBDC bill? Yeah. Literally has anti in the title. Now, I'm thinking that because it's not in the outlook, it's kind of still a bit distant. Is that a correct reading of that?
Well, I think that it's happening. I don't know what the real market impact should be outside of this, because if you think about it, you know, the CBDC issuance by the Fed was really, I think, geared towards...
Theoretical, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a theoretical thing, yeah. But I think it was geared towards providing more targeted stimulus payments. We did a white paper on this in my old job, basically trying to focus on, you know, certain industries in certain times when you're in a recession to encourage spending by issuing, you know, a tokenized fiat currency and saying, okay, you can spend, we're going to airdrop you $5,000, but you have to spend it on, I don't know, washers and dryers or some sort of, you know, durable goods or something like that. And this, the blockchain technology would allow basically them to track and make sure that you're spending the money in the way that they're intending it to do. And so it could kind of help alleviate certain areas of the economy that are struggling. But of course, the main pushback to that is all sorts of privacy concerns. So if they're gonna incentivize certain industries, or they're gonna track you and make sure that you spend it within a certain amount of time, to make it the most stimulative as possible, then of course there's a lot of folks here in this country that do not want that at all. So that's probably going to happen. I don't believe that, you know, it's going to have a significant market impact. You know, I guess you could say, like, you know, Bitcoin remains kind of like the de facto decentralized king and non-sovereign store value asset, but really, you know, it wouldn't be competing with Bitcoin regardless.
No, clearly. So,
Yeah, it's something completely different.
And it's almost like maintaining the status quo. We don't have a CBDC. Don't do it to CBDC. Therefore, right. The outcome is still the same effect that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, we also have players in the private sector that have already kind of solved this problem. I can't think of a single time that the government has entered to compete with the private sector and won. So I think it's really a nothing burger that they created the law.
For me, one major interesting thing, and then we'll go on just about this, is that the way that this might telegraph to other sovereigns, you know, you can avoid this. Basically, don't do a CBDC, and, you know, you don't actually need one, frankly. And I think that possibly speaks to our central bank, which is also in a sort of like experimental phase with CBDCs, that there's no major downside to not having one. You don't need to go that way with that route would block that blockchain technology, maybe Europe as well. Anyway, and then we are moving on to a really interesting section where we talk about secular themes. Now, the main headline in this section starts with something which is not crypto. Stocks to test scalability is the main headline. Equity trading has the potential to lead to layer one congestion, which is where it comes in. I've highlighted a section here whereby in Solana's case, approximately 1.8 trillion basically is what we expect is sort of like in terms of the incoming revenues from tokenization. Yet these figures remain modest compared to the 27.4 trillion, obviously, turnover generated by just seven of the most, you know, Mag 7 of the most liquid US equities. So in a way, this is possibly one of the biggest opportunities. What do you guys, how do you want to sort of dissect that?
So with tokenized stocks, really the thing that we wanted to emphasize is just how large the equity market is compared to the trading that we see on chain. Because we think, you know, 1.7 trillion in trailing 12-month volume on Solana DEXs is a lot. It doesn't even come close to what the Mag 7 does, where they're turning over 2 trillion a month.
Yeah.
And if we zoom in on that and we want to think about what Solana's volume did to the chain, in January, we saw about 400 billion of that 1.7 trillion volume 1 month. Transaction failure rates were north of 50%, north of 60% some days. Fees spiked 100, 150x. And that was 400 billion in trading volume. That's not even close to what the Mag 7 does. And the other thing to consider is that that's the Mag 7 trading volume on today's legacy settlement rails. So we're talking, we're opening at 9:30 and closing at 4.
Yeah.
The X stocks that Kraken's partnered with backed on, they trade 24/5 on Kraken's exchange. And then once you take these things on chain, that's 24/7, 365 trading. So that opens up entire other regions of the world that might have been pushing less volume through the US. I would expect we'll see an explosion, not just in Mag 7 volume, but on chain volumes that will push some of these things to the brink as well.
Wow.
I think it's kind of interesting, one, to just envision a world where you have all these people across the planet that found a lot of utility in crypto, primarily through stable coins. Well, now with putting these things on chain, they could feasibly, you know, have their Bitcoin allocation, have their US dollar, you know, allocation for either sending money abroad or just having some sort of hedge against their local currency. But then they could also invest in NVIDIA. You know, this is like, it's just very interesting because it's
paradise.
It just kind of opens up the, you know, the barriers for everyone. It really is kind of like the democratization of investing happening, right? By bringing this technology forward. And what, you know, what Mark just pointed out was, I think, a pretty compelling case to just show kind of like a fundamental reason on what could happen if you do see, you know, a continued increase in index volumes. You'll see a lot more network congestion, which is going to lead to a lot more fee generation and a lot more MEV. And so there's this pathway really that's just a fundamental catalyst for these layer ones to really capture a lot of value now.
And there's the potential for a lot of disruptions and upsets in what layer ones are leading. Because we saw Solana's whole rise in 2024 came because the Ethereum fees weren't cutting it and the trading wasn't fast enough. Well, if this thing overwhelms Solana and it's just too much, these can be issued. They'll be issued on Ethereum and they'll be issued everywhere.
Yep.
People will start going to the chains where it's going to be the cheapest and fastest. So it's going to create competition, and then that's going to create displacements in some of these prices where you'll see just unbelievable moves.
Yeah. Let's just quickly look at tokenization. Obviously, you mentioned our parent company Kraken and its X offering. So it's happening. Tokenization is happening right before our very eyes. But is it happening? What pace do you guys perceive it to be happening? Are we there yet, or is it still ramping up and probably likely to be another 12 months, 6 months, or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's very early days. Right. So the thing with that offering is that's only for non-US customers, because
right.
the US,
there you go. You see,
the SEC has had a little, they've been having discussions. They're thinking, if we tokenize these, and Hester Peirce has actually said, just because they're tokenized doesn't mean securities laws don't apply. So we need to figure out a framework for how do we actually enforce security laws on chain, and how do we make sure that everything is compliant so that US users can get access. Once the US gains access to that, like round the clock trading, that's where I see the adoption coming.
One, I think it's going to surprise people just how much participation you're going to get across the seas. So Robinhood also did their tokenized OpenAI offering. There's a lot of volume in that. I think that, and plus, let's be real, there's all sorts of ways that people circumvent this stuff. I think that the tokenization is really starting to is going to continue to just kind of accelerate, just because of the fact that you're going to see so many U.S. institutions really push for it. And even though it's not available in the U.S., we know that this is a regime that's going to ultimately probably greenlight this. And same with other technologies that are available in other regions like PERPs. You know, that's something that's going to be coming here to the U.S. as well.
Yeah. The CF Web3 Smart Contract Platforms Index is well positioned to benefit from new sources of demand for layer one block space related to this perspective. And then we go on to ETF flows, which we kind of talked about a little bit more. But the headline is ETF flows to top 50 billion in 2025. And I want to get you both to speak to what you see as the drivers of that, you know, kind of generalized forecast.
Yeah, so last year we saw about 52 billion in flows, just for context. So, and currently we're on pace for about 37. So we're really thinking it's going to accelerate in the back half of the year. And part of the reason for the slow pace this year is we saw those couple months of outflows during the elevated market uncertainty. There probably shouldn't be too much more of that, just given the bid that Bitcoin has. But one of the real key drivers, I think, it's going to be that multi-asset approval when the SEC gives that framework in a few months here. That's what's really going to drive demand for other assets. And then, of course, you'll see this steady bid for Bitcoin probably all throughout the year too.
Yeah, I think that our forecast is ultimately might be a little conservative. You know, February was the basis trade unwinding month. And then you had April, we saw actually pretty sizable inflows, which was the month of greater uncertainty. So on top of the multi-token stuff, you're going to have probably some basis-related inflows if we get another re-rating rally here, which is what we're on the doorsteps of. You know, Mark and I do a webinar where we break down the charts, and we've had a call for 126, 125, let's just say 125,000 for a target for Bitcoin, and then 150 next. So that's the type of displacement re-rating in Bitcoin price that can get you an actionable basis again, which leads to more fund inflows. You're seeing the basis trade start to happen in Ether. We're seeing evidence through the CFTC reporting and their leveraged net positioning. If you look at the net positioning there, you'll see that that's gone incredibly short. So Ether funds should continue to kind of get more fund inflows to handle the basis trading. So I think what we what we highlighted here is a good forecast, but it may ultimately be too conservative. I think our original forecast was that 2025 would beat 2024 fund inflows, and it could certainly surprise us, I think, on the second half of the year.
It's a prudent forecast. You know, it's a perfectly reasonable forecast given the circumstances. But, you know, can we all appreciate, guys, looking at the beautiful multi-token and altcoin ETFs chart, which is to the right of the main text in this section, that in the year that we're experiencing, basically your estimates remain for net inflows across the market beta, obviously dominated by the majors, but also altcoins too, right? And in only the first 3 months of the year, related to the tariff shock, I guess, are we seeing, you know, did we experience real outflows? So that seems to say a lot about what you guys are, how you're actually taking, you know, the policy atmosphere and how you're sort of projecting it into the future. It's quite eloquent regarding that, whilst it may not necessarily be too specific.
We've got some adjustments there for multi-token and for other single tokens, but we've kept it, like you said, very prudent. So we've got a bogey at 50 billion by this, you know, at the end of December, but I think that we could hopefully beat that.
Yeah. If we get a few strong months of basis trading, or if we, and there's also a potential unlocks too with staking in our single asset ETFs that could drive some
in kind. If you can, you're going to get another tailwind. So these are all things that, you know, we
could, under, right?
Yeah.
You guys are chomping at the bit to talk about basis trading. You came into the last section. We've got an actual section on basis trades to remain hot, subheading new CME contracts and ETFs to boost basis trading. I don't think we necessarily need to explain what basis trading is, but I think we need to contextualize why it's so important and why it's actually increasing in importance as we sort of like progress through this phase of the regulations and also the development of crypto. So I'll leave it to you guys to do that.
The basis trade's kind of been pretty hot in crypto because a lot of we've been doing some more research on the basis, and what we found is when you get that upside price volatility, that's really what's driving a lot of the basis. It's very sentiment driven, unlike, you know, other commodities where you'll see the risk-free rate kind of drives a little bit of the basis, and you'll see some of the storage costs drive the basis. I'm sure there's some sentiment in there, but it's nowhere near as volatile as crypto. And then the other kind of interesting setup that the crypto basis have is that unlocking of staking and ETFs that we mentioned earlier, because Ethereum's yielding, you know, close to 3%. Solana's yielding roughly 6.5%. So if you take that as your long leg and you're now yielding 3 or 6.5%, and then you're shorting the basis, so you're delta neutral, add 3 or add 6.5% to the basis, now you have a really attractive trade.
Yeah.
So as we get staking and as people kind of start to understand that and the market picks up on that, there should be plenty of flows into Ether and Solana. And you've actually seen Solana as high, and these are higher volatility than Bitcoin. So we have the Solana basis graphed on there, and you can see how this thing's blowing out to 25, 30, 40%, where Bitcoin was, it doesn't do that as frequently.
Yeah. So last year, one of the darling hedge fund trades was the Bitcoin basis trade. The year before that, it was the GBTC discount, right, on its NAV. This year, we think that the other tokens are going to get basically the same treatment. And as Mark was highlighting, when you have a proof of stake token like Solana or Ether, any green light, the ability to accrue value in the fund, that's going to make it even more attractive, because with any basis trade, you actually need to use a lot of leverage. So when we look at these annualized rates like we have on the chart, these are, you know, you can take, let's just say, the very high one. It's a 45% annualized rate that we saw briefly there on early June. Well, you have to divide that 45 basically by 12, right? And really, you have to divide it by a few, whatever days you had. So you really earned it, not just by, you know, 1 month, you know, the month of June, but maybe it compressed down, you know, you missed it or something like that. And after a few days, it was gone. So it's not like you're just earning, you know, 45% return right there by doing that type of compression. We're annualizing these rates. Long story short, the way that looks, you know, to become very attractive through hedge funds is they lever it up. So if you can make maybe 2% in one day, you know, that's, let's just say 24% annualized, or actually even more than that annualized. That doesn't sound too good, but if you can, you know, 10x that leverage, you know, that becomes a pretty attractive number there. So the leverage is key, and the fact that you've got a little bit of a carry now with these tokens in their staking components, that kind of makes, I think, things a lot more attractive. And just the fact that every hedge fund wants to find some sort of, you know, non-directional bet that's really an arbitrage in the market. And so the price discovery components really hasn't made its way fully yet into the CME futures curve for some of these tokens. And I would expect that to play a big hand in hedge fund activity going forward.
And you guys mentioned in your portfolio perspective for this one, Solana and XRP. It should actually go beyond that, in, you know, theoretically, but those are the key tokens that you would look to with respect to these influencers that you expect to be coming in.
Yeah, it's going to be, and it will always kind of be weighted, I think, a little more towards some of the larger cap tokens, just because as we start launching more futures contracts and we start getting further down, just the size you can allocate to, especially if you're levering it up, the size really does become constrained.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And right now we're just really seeing it on Ether, but I expect Solana to start showing that, especially with the Solana ETF that was just approved. So that's from the Rex Shares ticker SSK, I believe. And that has its staking, you know, staking reward enabled.
And then we come to a later section, probably the last main section, a corporate balance sheet at unlock. And this is obviously your strategy, formerly MicroStrategy, and a whole host of copycats that have been launched in recent months. Give us the sort of basics of this, guys.
Yeah, so the treasury company trade kind of got started, you know, with Strategy, and what they were able to quickly realize is there are sections of the market that want access to Bitcoin that just, they just can't buy it. It's not within their mandate. If you're running a convertible bond fund and you want that exposure, the only way to get it is to buy the MicroStrategy bonds. Or if your fund is focused on preferred equity or as an allocation to that, well, they have a preferred instrument that you can go and buy. Now, the tricky thing with Bitcoin is that it's a non-cash flowing asset, you have to be pretty mindful of how you manage that balance sheet to meet those obligations. Now, what's interesting with other assets, like specifically Ether and Sol, are these things are yield-bearing assets. So we've seen a few companies start to generate, we've seen one Solana treasury company and a handful of Ether treasury companies now. And when they start to issue debt and they issue these preferreds, the staking yields from Ether or Sol, they can totally help them meet those cash flow obligations. And then looking further than that, they can actually deploy these funds on chain. So look at Aave. Aave just hit $50 billion in its total pool. So it is of sufficient size where if you have $200 or $300 million in holdings and you wanted to put those in Aave and earn not just staking, but lending as well, you can do that. And then now you have a thing where you can match cash flows. You can maybe even look to match duration once you have fixed term instruments on chains. There's protocols like Maple Finance that issue those. So now it gives more financing opportunities to the corporate treasurers that Bitcoin previously didn't. So that's why we think this is going to be a pretty big trade over the next 12 months. And you could easily see this move from six companies to 60 plus.
Wow.
Well, yeah, one of the reasons why we wanted to throw this into our key themes for this quarter is just because we do see this as a material bid for digital assets, namely the ones that are in our UltraCap 5 index.
Okay.
Or, you know, kind of, let's just call them the mega cap tokens, where we're seeing, you know, ETH treasury companies, we see Solana treasury companies. So as far as how far down we think that's going to go, you could see a few more tokens, you know, but we see that kind of staying more in the large mega cap realm. But as Mark said, you know, we anticipate that number is going to dramatically increase because you're providing access to other markets. And yes, it's great that you can have the reward component, you know, help offset some of the financing costs if you do have coupons. Now, some of these tokens some of these treasury companies have been able to issue out, you know, pretty much 0% interest rate debt to acquire these tokens, and that's allowed for a lot of, I think, financial engineering, a lot of leverage, in which case, you know, the risk still remains, not so much the cash flow component, but the price component of the of the underlying. So does the, you know, and I'm not sure what strategies, you know, break even price is anymore, but I think we have a nice cushion. And until you see that cushion kind of evaporate, you should expect the premium for the securities that were issued, whether it's the preferreds or the convertible bonds, to kind of exist. So if those premiums exist, the market seems to be rewarding that. And if the market's rewarding that, just continue to see, you know, more adoption. And that's, you know, not to say it's going to be limited to the United States. This is a global phenomenon. So that's why it's so important to kind of bring that into our secular themes. We just had Elliot from Evolve on the podcast, just maybe the most recent one, right? So he just issued a Bitcoin treasury company on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it's happening.
Which
not
is
just
the CEO
in the US.
As well.
He's a CEO. So he's managed to, you know, get it off the ground rather quickly, and congrats to him. But this is, you know, I think a phenomenon that's spreading to other markets. And so it's very noteworthy to kind of, let's not pretend like this is an irrelevant thing. Absolutely. In the market. This is, you know, providing significant, this should continue to provide significant buying pressure going forward.
Yeah, and in addition to buying pressure too, it also provides a little bit of strength from a network fundamental standpoint, because now you have these institutional grade validators. Because they have a large stake, they have a vested interest in the success of the network, and you'll probably see some investment out of them into these overall ecosystems.
Yeah, that's a virtuous circle right there. Yeah. What I want to get you to do then is the traditional thing is, what is your main takeaway? If someone came to you and said, if someone says to ELDR, you know, you need to slap them upside the head, but basically give them a hint of what they should draw them in terms of key takeaways from your quarterly outlook.
For me, I think the TLDR is to not overthink the uncertainty aspects of it. If you want to be extraordinary in your portfolio, you're going to have to do extraordinary things and take extraordinary risks. Good news is that we're giving you, I think, a playbook here that allows you to simply do something rather boring, which is just maybe dip your toe into the asset class, get your first allocation, you know, 1%, 2%, 3%, and that will allow you to have some alpha. That's really what we're calling for. That's where you're going to find, I think, you know, as a former PM, a 2% to 3% allocation to this emerging asset class can provide significant alpha. When you compare it to 2% to 3% allocations in any other asset class, it probably wouldn't add very much. So you don't have to be extraordinary to get alpha this quarter or next quarter or the next 12 months, which is what our outlook is forecasting for. It's a 12-month outlook from each rolling quarter. Have to, I think, do something very basic, and that's, you know, get some sort of sleeve going.
And Mark?
I think for me, the key theme that kind of links everything together, it's really a regulatory unlock story. The thing that underpins almost everything is it's unlocking some type of new participant into the market. It's allowing some type of new asset to be traded or any new technology to exist. So I think if you're looking at a lot of the macro and the day-to-day uncertainty, you can sort of miss the forest for the trees. If you take a look at a high level, this level of regulatory guidance and clarity for crypto has never existed in the past. Most companies have been sidelined. Pensions have been sidelined. Endowment funds that would allocate to this have been sidelined. Governments have been sidelined. Foreign governments have been sidelined. All of that is changing. So that's what you really need to pay attention to.
Perfect. Perfect. I'm going to summarize. Gabe mentioned alpha. You know, this is actually an outlook report. It is essentially a forecast, a very, very prudent forecast with a lot of color. And as Gabe suggested, there's nothing, you know, there's no rocket science in there. Gabe and Mark simply lay out the scenario in detail. And, you know, you don't need to do anything crazy to actually benefit according to the outlook statement. As Gabe mentioned as well, we've done a number of these now. We have an Outlook podcast every quarter. We have a quarterly attribution report podcast from quarter to, you know, certain quarters. Coming on stream very soon, we'll have a Factor podcast as well. If you want to find those and whole host of other podcasts on other topics that we've done over the years now. You need to go to cfintermiles.com, scroll to podcasts, and after that, we'll see you again for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice.
This recording is not intended to persuade or incite you to buy or sell any financial products noted within, including but not limited to exchange-traded funds, mutual funds, equities, other instruments that reference any index provided by CF Benchmarks Limited, or crypto assets. Any commentary, interviews, and discussions are opinions only and should not be considered a personalized recommendation. Please contact your financial advisor or professional before making an investment decision. Note, some of the underlying instruments cited within this recording may be restricted to certain customer categories in certain jurisdictions.